The IPO window can be narrow. Be ready when it opens. Think timing is everything? Look again. Readiness is vital. Deloitte's audit and IPO readiness services can help companies prepare for IPO and exit opportunities. For example, a Deloitte audit is an opportunity for insight, one that can help leaders see further and deeper into their businesses and can help inform vital decisions. See how at Deloitte.com/US/EGC. That's DELOITTE.com/US/EGC. Welcome to Inc. for Starters with Alexa Von Tobel. I'm Alexa, a serial entrepreneur myself and founder and managing partner of Inspired Capital, a venture firm that backs fearless founders who are solving some of the biggest challenges facing humanity. Now in our sixth season, we sit down each week with one of the best founders on the planet to hear their story of guts, inspiration, and drive. Let's dive right in. Hi, everybody. This week, I want you to meet Naveen Rao, a repeat founder who is currently VP of Generative AI at Databricks. Most recently, Naveen started Mosaic ML in 2020 to enable developers to maintain full control over AI models that they build, with model ownership and data privacy built into the platform's design. In 2023, Databricks acquired the company for $1.3 billion. Prior to Mosaic, Naveen was the VP and GM of AI Products Group at Intel. In that role, he was responsible for artificial intelligence, product development, and strategy, including the deployment of new hardware architectures. He joined the Intel team in 2016 after they acquired his first startup, Nervana Systems, as a recognized leader in the deep learning field. Naveen has a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer science from Duke, and then spent a decade as a computer architect before going on to earn a PhD in computational neurosciences from Brown University. I'm grateful to have been an investor in Naveen's company, Mosaic ML. And with that, I want to welcome my friend and incredible entrepreneur, Naveen. Naveen, first of all, I'm so grateful to have you on today. And obviously, I've had a fun last year ever since I've gotten to know you. Let's just dive in first things first. What is Mosaic ML in your own words?
It's a company designed to democratize the capabilities of large language models and diffusion models, basically large-scale AI. We recognize that it was very hard from an infrastructural standpoint for most customers to be able to build these things, to deploy them, all of that. So we wanted to abstract the hardware away and make that easier, as well as really address the escalating costs of training and deploying these kind of large language models. We, through a lot of algorithmic innovation, software optimizations, brought the cost of training down like 10x and brought it from tens of millions of dollars down to sub $1 million. Still a lot of work to do, but I think this really makes it much more accessible to more organizations.
Take us back to the early days in 2020. You had already built a company. You already sold it. You are a repeat entrepreneur. What was the aha moment when you had the idea for Mosaic ML? And walk us through just how did you end up deciding to go and build another business?
Yeah, I mean, it was during COVID. I quit my previous role at Intel right before COVID hit. It was not planned that way. It just kind of happened. And, you know, we were all at home thinking about stuff. And I was just reading a lot of literature, and compute efficiency was something that's very near and dear to my heart. I'm a neuroscientist. And, you know, one of the singular facts that always just really amazed me and blew me away was that our brains run on about 20 watts of energy. That's it. That's less than your laptop. So there's something that biology does that's just magical. And I always wanted to kind of figure out how can we close that gap. So by different measures, we're something like 8, 9, 10 orders of magnitude away from that currently in synthetic computing. And even then, we're not really quite there from a capability standpoint. So it's very hard to ascertain this number. So I started reading literature, and there was a paper that stood out called the lottery ticket hypothesis. It was by Jonathan Frankel, who is now became the chief scientist of Mosaic. And I reached out to him and his advisor, Mike Carbon, just cold called them. And they responded. And we just started setting up a weekly meeting. And we said, hey, is there anything we can do from an algorithmic perspective? Can we actually change the way learning works in a neural network and make something vastly more efficient? So we came to the conclusion that, yes, there are actually lots of different venues to explore. And I would say that was the aha moment. I wasn't quite ready to start a company, to be completely honest. In my mind, when you start a company, it's about a business. It's not a science project. It's something that you can actually go and sell to customers and add value. And I wasn't quite there yet, but some of my friends in the investment community were like, hey, what are you working on? I told them a little bit about this. And they said, let's just write you a term sheet today and just get going. So we were off to the races. I think we closed the round on December 30th of 2020. So we really got going January 21.
That's amazing. I wish I knew then. I wish I got to check in then. I think most listeners are, of course, aware of ChatGPT, but can you walk us through what Mosaic ML's product does?
Yeah, so ChatGPT and other kind of chatbots like that are one manifestation of a large language model. Those are built to chat, be entertaining, maybe, you know, help people with writing and maybe with search, that kind of a thing. A large language model has lots of capabilities, especially in the enterprise. So chatting is one thing, but actually chatting about specific domains, pulling up information in real time, basically making interfaces that are human language for computers. And so what Mosaic does is really build the infrastructural components that allow you to build such models. So a company like OpenAI, who built ChatGPT, actually had to build all these infrastructural components themselves. First time you do something, it's always hard because there is no established pattern. But we saw this pattern as something that's going to recur and is going to add a lot of value to enterprise. And so we decided to say, hey, instead of having every company try to go spin up an effort to build this infrastructure, let's build those infrastructural tools. We can sell them and we can add a ton of value to these companies as they can build their own AI.
By the time I met you, Naveen, you had already gotten some really large customers to trust you. And one, you were at the bleeding edge and people were still trying to wrap their heads around, big companies especially, what to do in the category. Can you talk a little bit about your go-to-market and how you got people to trust you so quickly?
The first customer is always hard. Getting them to trust you, getting them to buy into your vision and what you're selling is really a founder's job, to be honest with you. So myself, Hanlon, Tang, other co-founder, like, you've just got to be intimately involved because you learn so much. As you go and try to pitch this thing, you're trying different things, right? When you go and talk to customers, some things you thought would be amazing that customers would love turn out to be not so amazing to them. Some things that you thought might have even been minor actually end up being very interesting. So that process of learning and honing the pitch is something that the founder has to do. And also, it's not just about the pitch, it's about adjusting what the product looks like. At that point, your product is probably still pretty malleable. So it's like, hey, if our product only did this thing, or we only had this capability, or we had this security thing, or whatever, we could make it work. Now, I think the dark side or dirty side of this is that sometimes you need to make some compromises in the short term just to get customers to trust you. Like we said, all right, look, the customer cares very much about security of their data. Let's give them all the reassurances by just setting up a really completely isolated sandbox for them. That's not necessarily how we want to do things at scale. And we knew that. But at that time, we didn't have the time to waste. Let's just set something up and get the customer. Getting feedback from the customer was actually the most important thing. So I think that's the way to think about it. It's like it's different phases. At the beginning, it's like getting the pitch down, getting customers to trust you, building some momentum, and then leveraging that to start iterating on your product and making it better and better.
Naveen, one of the things when we invested at Inspired that I immediately felt was going to be a very powerful moment of leverage was that roughly 50% of the businesses in the US economy are regulated, healthcare, financial services, where they're heavily focused on compliance.
Yeah.
Where they would not be comfortable to pull a data set from somebody else and say, great, I'm going to go ahead and run our company on this. Talk about how that helped your go-to-market.
Yeah, I think this idea that you can own and create IP around building a model, it was actually quite important. The fact that you can customize something and then you have full control over it. So what people didn't realize at the beginning when they first got excited about a large language model is like, okay, well, I have this model and there are fine-tuning services, but when I send my data to these services, I never see the weights. The weights are actually a function of your data. And in some ways, it's actually a version of your data you can think of. So a large language model can actually just regurgitate back your data, prompted the right way sometimes. So it actually presents a security risk for regulated industries when you throw data over the wall and say, okay, go train it and you host and keep the model. So we recognized this as an issue and said, well, I guarantee you that some of these regulated industries want access to these capabilities, but don't want to compromise on this control aspect. So can we build a product that enables them to have the control while still maintaining that kind of IP ownership? In addition to that, customization and differentiation are very important in every industry. It's always competitive. If you're a bank, they're competing banks. If you're a healthcare provider, they're competing healthcare providers. So you always want to leverage your data to make something that's unique. and actually outcompete your competitors.
Naveen, one of the things that you do better than many, many entrepreneurs is you can see the future. You have an idea and you see a thread line and you know to pull it. Give me a sense of how you know you're onto something.
This is a bit of a gut feel thing, but I think it's just understanding the technology well enough to really say what's going to be possible. So ideas are great. Ideas are actually not the problem. I actually think timing is as important to vision as the vision itself. And if you time something wrong, like let's say you're 10 years too early, it doesn't matter. Silicon Valley is littered with ideas that were 10 years too early. It doesn't mean you're not visionary, but it means that you didn't understand what it's going to take for that technology to really take off. And of course, if you're too late, you know, you're going to get outcompeted by incumbents. So there's this kind of narrow window of time. It's like a Goldilocks sort of a thing where you got to know a technology is ready to take off in 2 to 3 years. And that's the appropriate time to start investing in that and building towards it. And I think if you're 2 years out, you're at a point where most people didn't see it. And if you're more than 5 years out, no one saw it. I mean, maybe you're a visionary, but the market wasn't ready. So you got to balance these two things. And I think it's kind of recognizing a few trends that are coming together and putting it together into something that could actually be a product that adds value to an enterprise, to a company, to a customer.
You just led me to my next question, which is, if you fast forward 3 years, 5 years, what do you see?
Yeah, so grounding AI models to the real world and creating sequential outputs is something that's starting to work pretty well. It's still not solved. There's still a lot of work to do, don't get me wrong. But once you solve that, you actually open up a whole new area. If you step back and look at what a chatbot's doing, a generative model is actually producing sequential output that's maybe useful. Tons of hallucinations, things like that today. But what our brains do is, yeah, we talk, but we talk through muscle output. So being able to affect movement is actually inherent to something that is generative. And so starting to actually automate physical movement in the world, I think is going to be important. This is the area I think is pretty exciting, is that when we start to solve some of these inherent problems today that are in large language models, we can start to actually build robots that can learn to move. And this has been, you know, the sci-fi dream for many years. But now these new things that have actually come about from language are going to be applicable to robots. So I think we're probably in the window of 2 to 5 years for robotics starting to proliferate. We still have inherent problems of the technology of the physical robot. Building the physical robot is still somewhat expensive. So investing in that, making it cheap, and then the control systems are going to start to work in the next 5 years. That's my prediction.
I love that so much. If you have any other things that you see clearly in plain sight that maybe everybody out there doesn't have in their heads, what are those?
I think people over-rotated on what the capabilities of a large language model are. I mean, language is so intrinsic to us as humans that we saw when a model can speak back to us in English or a human language, they saw it as like, oh my God, we solved intelligence. We haven't solved intelligence. We haven't quite solved the ability for machines to directly learn from their actions. So what animals do really well is they create a hypothesis, which is the generative part. We create a hypothesis. We then, you know, munge that hypothesis into a set of actions or possible actions. And then we carry out a set of one of those actions and we observe the results. And we say, was this a good result or bad result? Or did this affect the world in the way I wanted it to? And then we go back and update that hypothesis generation. So this action loop, this sensory thinking action loop, doesn't really exist yet in generative models. If we crack that, to me, that's the thing that's in plain sight. We crack that, you crack a whole bunch of stuff. And I think that's when we start to really build these, what we call agentic behavior or agents, is really making them integrate this, the observations from the real world back into the generative aspects of the model, learning from doing.
Naveen, do you feel like that's 2 years away or 5 years away or longer?
I think it's within the five-year window. Some aspects of it. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be unstable. It'll work in some maybe constrained scenarios. But in 5 years, I think we'll have things that are really what I would define as agentic. Now, we have to find good use cases for them in those places where they work. Because it's not going to work generally. This is not going to be something I'm just going to like put out in the world. It's going to work. I think that notion needs to be modified, that we're just going to have some basic thing. And it's just going to go out and work and it'll figure it all out. Actually making an agent stable and making it work reliably over multiple scenarios will take time. That's more of like a 10-year thing in my mind.
Naveen, I want to transition to your sale to Databricks. You completed an acquisition just last year for $1.3 billion. You've sold two businesses. What made you decide to sell to Databricks?
I mean, there were a few things. I actually didn't want to sell the company. I had no desire to do so. I had sold the previous company, as you said, and I actually felt I shouldn't have, to be completely honest. I think we had a huge opportunity ahead of us there, and I cut it short. And I'm happy to describe why that happened. But largely, I will be really honest, it was fear. I was scared of what the world was going to look like. I took a very big bet personally. I had gone back to grad school. I'd gotten divorced. Life gets in the way. You know, my financial situation was not great. I had two kids I had to put through college at some point, you know, and this acquisition comes and it takes all of that pain away. So I actually felt a fair bit of regret for selling my previous company. And so I didn't want to do that again. Yeah. So in this particular case, you know, we had some other folks who came knocking as well. And it was very clear to me, just no, thanks. We're going to go on our own and build this company. And Databricks was different because one, Databricks is still kind of a big startup. I mean, yeah, it's 6,500 people and all of that, but it behaves like a startup. Founders lead it, very influential across all aspects of the business. And, you know, talking with Ali and the rest of the founders, culturally, it was also very similar. And so I didn't look at this as an exit. I looked at it as like joining forces. It was an accelerant. Because what I recognized is going after the enterprise with the tools that we're building has a market window. And, you know, there's risk in going at it alone. We had to build the proper sales force. We had to build a sales process, all of that kind of stuff. The hypothesis with Databricks was they have 1,500 person sales team that we could basically bolt onto and go faster. Similar kind of buyers, similar sales motion, similar business model. And so I looked at this as like an accelerant. And culturally, the values were very similar. I think all of the founders, except one, has a PhD. They came from academia in some ways like we did. The team is top-notch. Like the engineering team at Databricks is amazingly good. I mean, it's small still compared to like big tech companies, but the quality has been maintained at the highest levels. That's what I saw was just like, this is going to work. I can make this work. I don't think I'm going to regret it. And so really, you know, you got to have some faith that it's going to work out. And it just, again, comes from a gut feel.
Naveen, you've learned a lot about acquisitions.
Yeah.
Tell us what makes a great acquisition and what have you learned that goes wrong in acquisitions?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. I think at very big companies, very big tech companies that are, you know, 50,000 plus people, there isn't really strong alignment that, oh, everybody wanted to buy this company. And so when you come in, you'll find out, wait, there are people that were opposed to this acquisition. And that will start to cause friction in the system. And, you know, you may have heard the term antibodies, like those people will basically try to sink you because they didn't want the acquisition. You're stepping on their toes. And so that's, I think, probably the most prevalent thing I've ever seen is that you'll get people who are like, wait, hang on. I don't want the new kids here. You guys think you're hot stuff or whatever. We already have that. We can already do it. And so they'll go out of their way to sink you and they will have a lot more political capital in a large organization than you do. That's a failure mode that happens over and over again. I think that goes into a larger thing of you must have strong alignment on the core business. If you're a side business, honestly, I don't think that's going to be a great acquisition. It needs to be something that's super important to the core business. It could be a new direction, but it has to be important to the core business. If it's something on the side, you're not going to be successful. You're going to be an experiment, a toy, and you'll always be sidelined. And I think a lot of this even stems from just cultural alignment. If the companies are culturally misaligned, they will never be aligned. That's kind of what I've learned. That's why I focus so much on culture. We felt, myself, my co-founders of Mosaic felt a kinship with the folks at Databricks. We went to dinner with the co-founders, and honestly, I felt like I knew them. We were just kind of having conversations like we'd known each other for years. That's important. And it seems stupid and soft and squishy and all that stuff, but if that's not true, it won't work.
Amen. I thought that was brilliant. I've never heard somebody say that, Naveen. And we'll be right back after a message from our sponsors. Naveen, I want to transition to you. You are a repeat entrepreneur. You grew up in rural Kentucky. I was born in Kentucky. I love that about you. What do you think your parents did that helped you have the part of you that makes you this successful?
I don't know. I've been asked that question before, and I even asked my parents that, and they're like, we don't know. We just sort of did the best we could. I mean, in India, there was this big diaspora of folks out in the 70s, and my parents left India in the 60s. I was born in the UK. when they moved from India to the UK. And, you know, I kind of look at this trajectory of my parents. They actually married outside of their caste, which in India at that time in the 60s was a big no-no. Then they had a lot of family tension and they left the country and went to the UK. And then they left that country and came to the US. And I look at that and I'm like, well, you know, obviously they were risk takers. I can't imagine a lot of people just uprooting their entire life and moving to a new place. It's actually, most people don't do that, especially when there's these huge cultural differences. This is before the internet. It's before people really had phones everywhere. It's a big risk for them to take. And so I think just having that as an example of like, well, it's not that big of a deal to take those risks. So it was just normalized. But then also, like, I think my parents just, they let me fail a fair bit. And I try to do that with my kids as well. It's like, you can't helicopter, you can't help them all the time. You have to fail. That's how you learn. You've got to feel pain. I think, you know, it's funny, Jensen Huang at NVIDIA said this in a Stanford talk, and I think he got a lot of flack for it. But he's absolutely right. Succeeding over and over again doesn't build that grit. You have to feel the pain of like, holy shit, I failed. I put everything I had into this thing and I still failed. Why? Right? Why did I fail? And it like makes you feel like garbage. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but like I have felt like I am worthless so many times. And that's what makes you strong. When you get past that and you're like, wait, hang on, let's rebuild. Why did I fail? Let's analyze it. And then learning from that, never letting it happen again.
I mean, I love that so much. You have to fall down and get right back up and learn to rebuild. And it's got to be in you. And actually, there's a confidence of that too. You can knock me on the ground and I'm going to get right back up.
Exactly. After you do it a couple of times, you're like, you know what? Yeah, it sucks. It sucks to feel that way. But after you've done it, you have this meta understanding almost. You know what? This sucks. And I know it sucks, but I'm not going to let it happen again. I'm going to figure out why. And I'm going to learn from this. You get to pull strength from it, you know?
I love you, Naveen. What have you learned from your first business to your second business that you'll take to your third business? What do you carry with you?
The first business, I did lots of things wrong. I mean, I think we did a lot of things right. I think the overall vision, a lot of that was correct. What we did wrong was people. When people are not aligned, I mean, it's one of these things, you almost learn to be a little more just decisive and maybe even somewhat harsh, where you're like, okay, well, look, if you're not on board, we can't tolerate that. When we're a 20-person company, I need everybody on board. And if you're not on board, I don't care how smart you are. We just got to move on. Having that confidence to know that I can go and convince other smart people to come join me is something I learned. And, you know, at Nirvana, we had an amazing team that was very much on board. Obviously, we always had problems. Every company has these kinds of things. But acting quickly is important. Sensing when there is lack of direction or lack of focus in certain things. I think that's just something you gain as a leader over time. It's like, wait, I'm feeling something is off here. It's on you. I didn't say something right. I didn't express what the focus should be. So taking that back and saying, okay, why is the team doing this? They're all on board, but like somehow they're not focused. That's on me. I didn't say it right. So I think putting in processes for checking this stuff and then resyncing the company. I mean, like at Mosaic, I think we did a good job of it. We would have quarterly get-togethers in person. We'd all spend a day or two together. Myself and my other co-founders would come up with, this is what we're focused on for the next 3 months. And when you do that and you make it crystal clear, it can't be 100 things. It's 3 things that will land with your team.
I love it. Naveen, building businesses is extremely stressful. It just is. We both know that. How do you manage stress? What are the ways that you've gotten good at taking those punches to the face?
Yeah, this is actually a really good point. I think it's something that people don't talk about much. The best entrepreneurs and executives I've met are actually just kind of inherently good at managing stress. They don't let things bother them sometimes, or you can compartmentalize. But I think strategies for this are working out, eating well, sleeping well. I used to race bicycles. I love biking. That is the best stress relief there is. If I'm stressed out or nervous about something or whatever, I just go for like a 2-hour bike ride, get your heart rate up, you know, to its max a couple of times. And then all that stress kind of melts away. It's kind of magical, really. I found that to be the best possible thing I could do. I think obviously there are people who are extremely successful who maybe didn't do that. So everyone has their own strategies, but probably even spending some time with friends, family, and talking about other stuff, kind of disconnecting, actually is very important as well. If you just stay in that bubble of work the whole time, you may feel like you're being productive or you're being a great example to your team, but those days where you're just like, I can't do it anymore. Don't do it. Get away. Go for that bike ride. Go hang out with your, you know, significant other or your family or whatever, and just get a break from it. I think we're all human, and recognizing those limitations is actually important. And, you know, I think you get a better sense for this after you've been inundated with, you know, decision fatigue. It's a real thing. After a point, you're like, I can't even think. I can't even make another decision. All right, just step away. The business isn't going anywhere. You're fine. Take a couple hours, get yourself right, come back.
Yeah. And I agree with you that we don't talk enough that one of the greatest assets and skill sets of leaders, CEOs, founders is actually being really good at managing stress.
It is.
We're going to move to the quick fire round. I'm going to ask a question. First thing that comes to your mind, we'll go from there. What is a book that has materially left a dent on you of any kind?
Recently, the John Haidt stuff, Righteous Mind, his kind of framing of what motivates people. I know it's not necessarily deep science on what I work on daily, but I think understanding people is very important. And if you can really understand what makes people tick and why we behave the way we behave, that's important.
What is a quote that you live by?
It's a Nietzsche quote. Any human can endure the how if they know the why.
Oh, I love that, Naveen. That's so good. You obviously love to build incredible teams. So what is an interview question you like to ask to get to the core of who somebody is?
What do you do outside of work? I want to see people who are like pushing themselves in various areas. If you push yourself in one thing, you probably push yourself in another.
I love that one. I never heard that thread there. I like that a lot. What is to date your biggest pinch me moment of your career?
Oh boy. You know, it sounds silly, but probably when founding my first company, Nirvana, getting Steve Jurvetson a term sheet from him. It was $3 million. That's it. But to me, it was like, wow, these people who are really smart think I'm reasonably smart enough to give me their money to actually go build something. Just a sort of a confidence builder, I guess.
I love that. Last question. What is one category of innovation that you are gravitating towards intellectually right now?
I think this idea of building AI that is truly in this thought action observation loop, it's going to require a paradigm shift from what we have today. It's not going to be a large pre-trained model. So I think intellectually, that's just what I've been thinking about a lot. Really, how can we start to solve this with the pieces we have, or at least make a dent in it?
I love that. Naveen, first of all, thank you so much. As I said, you really are somebody that I just admire so much. I'm so grateful to have you on today. Everybody out there, if you want to learn more about Databricks, head to Databricks. You can learn so much more about Mosaic ML out there. And you can join us next week for a new episode of For Starters with Alex von Tobel. Naveen, thank you so much. I'm rooting for you. I will always be rooting for you. Deloitte understands that one size doesn't fit all. Each emerging growth company has its own unique needs and issues at different stages of growth. As your startup grows, Deloitte aligns its approach to adapt to that growth. Quality is their top priority. Their approach to client services focuses on the priorities and challenges of high growth companies, the road to IPO, and a commitment to the venture capital community. From startup to IPO and beyond, Deloitte is here to help. See how at deloitte.com/US/EGC. That's Deloitte.com, DELOITTE.com/US/EGC.